Welcome to this panel on the book Religion and the News. We've got four panelists who are going to give a 10 to 15 minute position paper, sort of semi-review, semi-reflection on the book Religion and the News. And then we'll have some guided discussion. This is a joint panel being hosted by the Religious Studies Project. David and I produce this in association with the BASR, so that's the Religious Studies Project. And the other co-host of the panel is the Journal of Religion, Media and Digital Culture, the editor of which is sitting here. Tim would like to say something briefly about that.
Religion, Media and Digital Culture is a new journal started last year. We publish articles, as you can probably guess, on anything to do with religion and media, but looking particularly at digital culture, looking for articles, but also briefer research reports, book reports. So if you have been foolish enough to give a talk at any point in this conference that has something to do with media, you will probably get an email from me in due course directing you to our call for papers.
Wonderful. So without further ado, just to introduce the book briefly, Religion and the News is an edited volume published by Ashgate in October 2012. It was edited by Jolyon Mitchell of the University of Edinburgh, who's the director of the Centre for Theology and Public Issues there. And he's also lecturer in Communications, Theology and Ethics and convener of the Theology and Ethics subject area. And Owen Gower, who is a senior fellow at Cumberland Lodge, which is an educational charity specialising in cross-sector cooperation and matters affecting the development of society. And it brings together academics, practitioners, and media professionals in a collection of 19 chapters exploring everything from the news coverage of the Occupy protests at St. Paul's to the representation of Sikhs in the mainstream media, from the problematic notion of journalistic neutrality to the problematic definition of religion. And reflecting this diverse range of perspectives in the book, we've brought together four academics here today who each have a unique position on the contents of the book from their positions working with or indeed for the media. So it'll be a sort of semi-review, semi-reflection, and we'd like to keep it semi-formal. That's the Religious Studies Project way. But without further ado, our first panelist, we're going to go with David Wilson first, then Christopher Landau, Eileen Barker, and finishing with Tim Hutchings. So David Wilson wears many hats. He served as a solicitor and then partner and managing partner in Scotland, United Arab Emirates, Oman and Egypt before deciding to try his hand at the academic study of religion. His PhD at the University of Edinburgh focused upon spiritualist mediumship as a contemporary form of shamanism, and his monograph has just been published with Bloomsbury, titled Redefining Shamanisms, Spiritualist Mediums, and Other Traditional Shamans as Apprenticeship Outcomes. Wearing one of his other hats, David is a practicing spiritualist medium and healer, and among his many connected roles, he is currently the president of the Scottish Association of Spiritualist Healers. David.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good to be with you. I'm going to do a general review of the book, and as an academic and a religious practitioner and a radio interviewee on occasion, I have a choice of perspectives from which to respond to this edited collection of essays. At various points in this paper, I will make use of each of these, but regardless of perspective, the first contribution in the collection powerfully brings home the point that this is fundamentally a book about relationship. Specifically the relationship, or network of relationships, between religious practitioners and journalists. The main difficulty with this relationship is that the two parties involved belong to distinct and quite different discourses. The relationship with religious practitioners is not the most important one in journalists' working lives, for the most part, and vice versa. And further, Mitchell, in Chapter 1, is among a number of contributors to highlight conflict as a recurrent journalistic trope, whereas most religious practitioners will, I suspect, whatever their actual practice, at least make some attempt to adhere to a more positive rhetoric. The next three chapters reach some interesting conclusions on the basis of statistical contributions that appear to highlight differences between media. Tyrapula Knot detects a BBC bias in favour of historically familiar religious traditions, including folk traditions, but against common religion, which is a category that seems to be similar to Martin Stringer's basic form of religion. A practical engagement with the non-empirical, such as fortune-telling, the use of psychics, unexplained phenomena, and so on. So the conclusion there is the BBC exhibits a socially conservative bias. The categorisation of my own tradition, spiritualism, catches my eye in this chapter. Tyrapula Knot include it in their common religion category, the one that's less welcome at the BBC. Yet, this is a religion with churches and a familiar panoply of officials, including ministers who conduct weddings and funerals, in the context of forms of service that are recognisably Protestant Christian in derivation. And to be fair, spiritualism can be a challenging customer. Some spiritualists bristle at the suggestion that they are Christian. Others bristle at the suggestion they might not be. So journalists are not the only ones who can find the process of categorisation a little bit tricky. And that might seem picky, but I make this point in part because the contributors of chapters 2 and 3, Gill, have contrasting conclusions to offer, even though their conclusions are drawn principally upon the basis of quantitative data, apparently gathered in similar fashion. And part of the reason for this may lie in their use of different categories, i.e. different definitions, in order to interpret the data. And as I pointed out in other contexts, the definitions we use are essentially summaries of the research questions we are asking. As we all know, the questions we ask do have a habit of dictating the answers we develop. Tyrapula Knot make the point that religion tends to appear in the news when it has political significance. Discernible in their analysis is a BBC or establishment bias in favour of traditional forms of Christianity, as against more secular attitudes in other media organisations that tend to have a more liberal leaning. And this raises the possibility that religious traditions like spiritualism, which have historic affiliations with radical social causes, simply fall between two horses, as it were. If the political left doesn't do religion, and the political right only recognises certain traditions as religion, there is every likelihood that much of what people actually do as their religious practice will simply go overlooked. Again, categorisation matters. Our definitions bound what we are aware of, excluding as well as including. The use by different researchers of the same terms to mean slightly different things is perhaps a normal part of academic conversation, but it is, I think, an underlying reason why there might seem to be a confusing set of trends in the data within this book. So you may have guessed I speak from a position of personal preference for interpretive research, which leads me to welcome not only Paul Woolley's contribution in Chapter 4, but the further contributions that make up Part 2, chapters 5 through to 9. And these comprise some very valuable self-reflexive contributions by journalists, some of whom are working within their own religious traditions and for religious publications. Woolley takes us back to the opening point that religious practitioners and journalists inhabit different perceptual worlds, different discourses. And he acknowledges that there is a widespread lack of religious literacy among journalists. My own thought is that in part this may reflect the liberal arts background of many journalists, whose education derives from scholarly traditions that are in some degree the product of past struggles to be free of religious control. It is perhaps no surprise that a number of contributors to this volume note a higher degree of secularity or lack of religious affiliation among journalists than among the British population at large. There is a fair bit of relationship building and learning to be done, particularly if, as Christopher Landau puts it, religious practitioners are to become skilled and confident enough to play the media at their own game. Ruth Gledhill is a lovely writer. Her mellifluous prose gently meanderingly guides us to, if not an enthusiastic, at least amused acceptance of the robust messiness of the journalistic arena. Despite her appropriately ecclesiastical, civilised tone, we are reminded that it takes discipline, training, commitment, and good old-fashioned guts to take part in this contest, let alone score points. And herein lies a fundamental difficulty. Religious practitioners very naturally put their time and energy into practicing their religion. And many regard that private example as their most effective way of being publicly evangelical. All relationships take time and effort. Relationships lived with other real individuals can seem much more attractive and productive than mediated relationships that may or may not happen as a result of fuller, more nuanced, journalistic representations of one's own tradition. As Gled Hill and Beckett point out, if I, as a religious practitioner, have the time and energy to articulate my tradition for the benefit of outsiders, I can now do it directly through Facebook pages, Twitter accounts, WordPress blogs, which I do. So why put time and effort into helping journalists do their job better, especially when they get paid for it, and I quite possibly do not? Well, two responses are possible here. First, as Gled Hill points out, retreats from the hurly-burly of life in whatever context often seems tempting, but is really productive. And secondly, if the contributions by Gled Hill, Beckett, Pepinster and Brown in this book are anything to go by, at least some journalists are keen to see closer engagement and more informed reporting of religious traditions. And I think this is something as scholars we should seek to encourage. When it comes to recording and interpreting patterns of religious activity in Britain and Western society more widely, we have sometimes as scholars been badly misled by simply noting declining church attendances and failing to maintain scholarly attention on what people actually do when not in church, or mosque, or synagogue, or temple. And there are practical reasons for this, and awareness of them is leading to more balanced perspectives, but a stronger media religion discourse could do much to enhance the resources available to scholars of contemporary religion, as well as scholars interested in mapping other discourses, such as secularism and atheism, that have developed with reference to religious activity. From the perspective of many religious practitioners, however, such points may still not be quite persuasive enough to overcome sensitivity to particular portrayals of one's own tradition. The media do not report lived reality. Instead, they report newsworthy bits or bites, which, as mentioned, generally mean disputes, schisms, or outright conflict. And as Charlie Beckett and Catherine Pepinster remind us, journalists are first and foremost storytellers competing for the attention of their audiences, whose craft requires them to present narratives with a beginning, a middle, and an end, with interesting characters, unexpected turns of events, and dramatic plots. So we have here two quite different experiences of life. It may therefore come as a surprise when I say that my own limited experience of engagement with the media, in the form of radio interviews with commercial broadcasters, has been almost entirely positive. It inclines me to listen to Beckett's claim that religion gets a pretty fair deal on the whole. And I say this conscious that my own tradition, spiritualism, which coheres around the practice of mediumship and asserts that life after death can be demonstrated using non-journalistic forms of communication, is one that lends itself to ridicule from both other religious and from scientific perspectives as developed in Western culture. And I say it also in the knowledge that some of my co-religionists have had much less happy experiences with the BBC, coming away feeling angry and insulted, vowing never to have anything to do with the media ever again. A lot can do with the handling of the way that interviews and radio programmes and so on are actually set up. The contributions in part 3 of the book reflect a similar variety of experience. Journalists have long worked with familiar tropes, phrases in their products. Much of what they do is not the telling of new news, but the retelling of gnarled narratives that have their origins not in religion, but in more widespread cultural stereotypes. We're all familiar with the Muslim terrorist, the self-deprecating rabbi, the ineffective vicar we acknowledge but don't actually listen to, the ferocious Sikh no fool would cross. It is telling that the book we're discussing enables intelligent, humane responses to lazy prejudices such as these, but that the news, by and large, does not. The stumbling block is that the number of people who will read and reflect upon the contributions to this book is tiny as compared to the number who will be reinforced in their subscription to stereotypes by consuming newspapers or news broadcasts. Most of the contributors acknowledge this mismatch and detail its various consequences, while agreeing there is no easy solution. This is why, to revert to my opening point, this is a book about the importance of relationship. The only common suggestion as to dealing with the mismatch I highlight is the possibility of improved relationships between religious practitioners and those who represent them, enabling a process of learning and education about each other. Yet, good relationships take time, which is why a single life does not have room for an infinite number of them. My worry is that the lack of boundaries, characteristic of the internet, including as to speed of response, will prove even more inimical to this goal than printed newspapers ever were. This is an excellent book, full of detailed insight born of rich experience, which I have enjoyed reading and reflecting upon. But in a sense, it's not news. This is the difficulty taken up in the final part of the book, that it's striking that while the contributors highlight the same difficulty, they appear to be agreed there's no easy way forward. But there is one suggestion that caught my eye, and just by way of my own conclusion, I want to quote a paragraph from Simon Barrow's final paragraph on page 182. He says, "Journalists have an inbuilt professional tendency to prefer speech, however noisy, to silence, however profound. As well as venerating headline-worthy bad news over worthy but undramatic good news. Only engagement and subversion will challenge this. A new generation of religious dramatists producing mystery plays for a new generation is needed. This is why the willingness and capacity of ordinary people, religious and otherwise, not just to join the new media circus, but to improve it by offering a different style and fresh content is so important. The revolution is on, but it is in its very early stages, and it is not being televised. That was yesterday's medium. Today's and tomorrow's is multi-platform."
Thank you, David. We can have applause on the recording. Okay. Well, thanks for that brilliant overview of the book from your perspective, and a few very insightful questions there. So now we've got Christopher Landau, who is one of the contributors to the book. He studied theology at Cambridge University before gaining a BBC News traineeship in 2002. He spent 8 years at the BBC working as a radio reporter and a television news producer, both in general news journalism and as a specialist covering religion. He was a reporter for Sunday and then World at One and PM on Radio 4 before being appointed World Service Religious Affairs Correspondent in 2008. In 2010, he left the BBC to begin doctoral studies at Oxford University, combined with training for ordination in the Church of England. He is involved with a project to establish a religion media centre, based on the model of the Science Media Centre. So maybe you can tell us a bit about that in your presentation as well. So, Christopher.
Thank you very much. And I should say that as a contributor to the book and someone who was at the initial conference, which then led to the publication of the book, I suppose I'm rather on side with the project. So you're not going to get particularly critical comments about the book itself from me. Jolyon Mitchell, I think, is coming to this conference this evening. Sends his apologies for not being able to be at this session. But he did say to me that one point that he felt might be helpful to put across was the decision not to call the book a reader and not to suggest that it comes up with some overall coherent reading of the interaction between religious organisations and the news media, but rather to say that the point of the initial conference was about bringing together two sides of a debate that don't often engage about the practice of what they do. And similarly, the book was designed to enable that sort of exchange. And it was great to hear from David the way that he valued those journalistic perspectives standing alongside the religious ones. I thought I might begin by underlining what for me always was very important when working as a journalist and then engaging with religious organisations, which was about giving a very realistic definition of what constitutes news. Because I think sometimes these sorts of discussions can proceed on a slightly idealistic basis about what we might hope might constitute news. But in the end, Margaret Thatcher dying eclipses all other events, bar perhaps North Korea, you know, actually launching a weapon at the moment. A working definition of news is something that somebody somewhere would rather was not made public knowledge. And so journalists are often working, and their currency, if you like, is, well, the more unusual the fact that they are bringing to light, the bigger the story. And in a sense, it's as simple as that. But the context in which journalists are now doing that work is so changed even from 5 or 10 years ago. I remember when I started out at the BBC, for example, at certain set-piece occasions, like a religious organisation's general synod or, you know, committee meeting or whatever, those of us who worked for broadcasters would dash off at the end of the day to get to the next hour's bulletin, while Ruth Gledhill and others from the print media would retire to the pub, compare notes, decide what their lines were, and then ring in their story or write their story and email it, you know, by 9 o'clock at night or whatever. And of course, over the course of the last few years, for them, the landscape has shifted extraordinarily in terms of the desire to blog, the need to even just get the news story up on a newspaper website as quickly as it will appear, say, on the BBC News website or on a radio bulletin. And what that means is that the amount of time for journalists to do what you or I might think or hope is real journalism is ever diminished. And so certainly from a broadcast perspective, unless you're, if you like, off rota and working on a documentary or a weekly programme, the amount of time you actually have to do the sort of work that we might all agree would constitute really decent journalism, well, those opportunities are very much diminished. And that is very much the context that we're talking about. Now, that is a context which affects all news journalism. But there's also then the question of whether there are particular issues in relation to religion. The recently retired Bishop of Southwark, Tom Butler, used to use the phrase in relation to journalists that they were a metropolitan, liberal, secular elite. And if that's who journalists are as their basic starting point, is it any surprise if they then write stories in a way which might betray those prejudices? And I think there's something in that. There was certainly interesting research, and I'm just wondering what's going on behind me, but no, that's all right. It's not a kind of embarrassing archive picture of me, which was my main concern. There was some interesting research done for the Guardian Television Festival some years ago, which showed this gaping gap. It was something like 20-odd% of people working in television were religious, compared to the figures of 80-odd% of the British public will proclaim some kind of nominal contested religious commitment. But in terms of the same question being asked, there was this extraordinary mismatch between people working in television and the population as a whole. Coupled with that is the issue of religious literacy among journalists. In part, I think this is an issue born out of the fact that, well, if it doesn't really figure in your own life and you're not really sure that it really matters to anyone anyway, or should, then why would you bother learning very much about it? And I think it is certainly the case that while mainstream journalists would be expected to have a certain baseline understanding, for example, of politics or economics, they wouldn't necessarily be expected to have the same basic understanding of religious affairs, even at the most rudimentary level. And indeed, that's one of the issues that has prompted, as another outcome from the Cumberland Lodge conference of a few years ago, the proposal to develop a religion media centre along the same lines as the science media centre. Just to give you a moment of background on that, some years ago there was a House of Lords inquiry into media coverage of science, and one of the conclusions was that some kind of institution that might broker a better relationship and particularly act, if you like, as a press office on behalf of science, particularly at those moments when scientists are tearing their hair out at a Daily Mail headline that says chocolate causes cancer, and the success of the Science Media Centre in headline terms, if you like, has been to ensure more often than not that in those sorts of situations, it may just be that in paragraph four, there is a reputable scientist saying, by the way, this is one cranky study. And the Daily Mail may still run the headline, but the story isn't completely free of informed scientific comment. And certainly in terms of religion, whether you're talking about the mass market religions, if you like, or the niche traditions that we've also heard about, there is this huge challenge of, do the people who are part of those traditions recognise themselves in media coverage of their own faith or practice? And certainly that was always my rule of thumb if I was doing a report, A, that I didn't want my first interview with someone to be my last, B, that if I was representing faithfully the tradition in question, actually people don't tend to mind you asking the tough questions, because they tend to know that those are real issues anyway, as long as you're not doing that in a disproportionate way. One other observation is just the way that, probably as a result of 9/11, the tide seems to have turned to a certain extent in terms of the media and perhaps society as a whole regarding religion as worth reporting. And I think the set text for this is the book God is Back by the Economist overall editor and their Washington bureau chief. The fact that two impeccably secular journalists working for an impeccably respected publication that doesn't exactly go out of its way to do religious affairs coverage, although it does a lot more now than it did 5 years ago, the fact that those two men are writing a book about the resurgence of religion in world affairs, I think is very telling. So finally, just a couple of more personal reflections on my own engagements. I never really found within the BBC that there was a bias against religion if you were prepared to fight for the stories to have airtime. But there was often the reality that there would be editors for whom religion really wasn't part of their life. And so they had to take a bit of an imaginative leap to begin to think that it was worth taking seriously. And I do remember one example where I suggested that the criteria by which a story that I was wanting to run was being questioned would not be given to an economics correspondent wanting to run a story about mortgage rates and people complaining that not everyone owned a house, and therefore why was it an interesting story to run. And those kinds of analogies, I think, are quite interesting in terms of trying to think through actually whether one likes it or not. Religion remains a very significant force in world affairs, and not just to those who are religious themselves. You may want to ask more, but I had an intriguing experience myself when interviewing Rowan Williams about Sharia law and the ensuing firestorm of coverage about that, which I think most tellingly exposed the extent to which the media knows so little about Islam and carries so much prejudice and concern about Islam. And finally, I suppose I would be interested to hear your thoughts or reactions to someone who is doing what I'm doing, and in a sense going from poacher to gamekeeper, if you like, to from a position of supposed neutrality and impartiality to, you know, pinning my whatever it is to a mast, you know, and doing so in a terribly, you know, establishment and, you know, way. But how does this, from a sociology of religion perspective, cash out? The BBC used to tie itself in all sorts of knots, trying to understand what it meant by its commitment to impartiality, and whether impartiality does actually mean the same as neutrality, and what it means for people with religious convictions themselves to report on religion, commentate on religion, make programs about religion. And I think that those sorts of questions about how we, whether in media or in the academy, deal with these questions are still very much live issues. And I do think that the book provides a pretty useful source text for some very frank reflections from both sides of what can be a considerable divide. Thank you.
Thank you, Christopher. Yes, hopefully we can get on to discussing that in the discussion at the end. So our next speaker is, she's going to get an introduction whether she needs an introduction or not. It's Eileen Barker. He's Professor Emeritus of Sociology with special reference to the study of religion at LSE. Her main research interests are cults, sex, and sects, sorry, get that right.
Oh, that too.
Oh, yeah. And new religious movements, and also changes in the religious situation in post-communist countries. She has over 350 publications translated into 27 languages, which include the award-winning The Making of a Muni and New Religious Movements, A Practical Introduction. In the late 1980s, with the support of the British government and mainstream churches, she founded Inform, an educational charity based at LSE, which provides information about minority religions that is accurate, objective, and as up-to-date as possible. So maybe doing what the media are supposed to do. And she's a frequent advisor to governments, other official bodies, and law enforcement agencies throughout the world, has made numerous appearances on television and radio, and has been invited to give guest lectures in over 50 countries. So that's Eileen's perspective. Off you go.
Perspective. Well, I've been asked to talk about my own experience, especially through Inform, about the relationship between the media and religion. But I do want to say that I really do think this is a good book. I did enjoy reading it. And one of the main reasons I enjoyed reading it is that it isn't a reader. As Christopher said, it's this collection of different perspectives. I sort of balked somewhat when you said the two sides, because actually reading it, I didn't find there were two sides in a way. There was a sort of continuum, and some of the media people were arguing just the same as the religion people. And both of them tended sometimes to do mea culpa and at other times to sort of go on their, follow their own wagon and justify themselves. But I really liked the fact that most of the chapters were very short, and so they had something to say and they went ahead and they said it. And I thought that there was a kind of growth. You kept thinking, yes, yes, yes. And although there was a lot of conflicting ideas in it, there was also this sort of ability, because there were so many different viewpoints, to build up a multidimensional picture instead of just having them against them on the other side. And I really appreciated that and think it was a good thing. As far as my own experience is concerned, I found, as a sociologist of religion, I very often had to be a sociologist of knowledge in recognizing some of the things that were very central to this book about how people build up images through their interests, selecting in certain things and deselecting, not including other things, in these images that they pick up. I think it's Andrew Brown who says what to put in and what to keep out. And I think this is very important. And somebody else talks about how the same story, if it's written by different people with different interests and with different audiences, which is important, they will come up and stress, select certain things and not others. And my field is new religious movements, cults or sects. And this tends to be somewhere where the selection has been very extreme. So the new religions will present themselves as wonderful, having the truth, and they keep quiet about skeletons in the cupboard, whereas their opponents, the anti-cultists, will just pick out the bad things that they do and don't recognize anything that could possibly be good. And the media pick out the things that are exciting, sexy, bad, because a bad story is a good story, and novel. They tend to be uninterested in things that are boring, normal, everyday, and not sexy. Whereas, of course, as sociologists of religion, we want to be objective and balanced. When you said that inform gives accurate information, it's as accurate yes. as possible. I'm not going to go down that road, but don't yeah. push me down okay. it just by what you said, as this is being recorded. What we try to do is present a more objective and balanced view. Well, in the 1970s, because I'm very old and that's when I started studying them, the media almost unanimously just had stories about the cults that were that they brainwashed, they were evil, they child abused, they financial skullduggery, political intrigue, etc., etc. And you just didn't find anything good about them. They might have been more or less interested in religion, but they were certainly not sympathetic towards the cults. Everything was bad, and they had stories that came from worried relatives, ex-members, politicians who wanted to get on a bandwagon or something, who all had an interest in building up this, not only urban, moral panic. And then they started to get a bit more balanced and decide that they needed to have perhaps the other side. And they were talking in sides, so they would have opponents and perhaps bring along a member of a new religion, but not very often. They were more likely quite often to get somebody like me. And if they wanted information, I've been phoned up quite often saying, you know, how many Moonies are there now in Britain? So I said, well, I don't know. I mean, a couple of months ago there was so-and-so. Why don't you phone so-and-so who keeps the score? Oh, I can't phone them. And there was some sort of idea that they wouldn't get the truth if they phoned the Unification Church. So I would phone the Unification Church. And then I would tell them, which is slightly peculiar, but still. This happened a lot, and then often you'd get slightly silly questions like, are they genuine religions or are they a cult? At least I thought they were rather silly questions, but they were very fundamental questions that kept coming up and that they wanted to know the answer. If they got that far, rather than just assuming they were cults, what is a cult? Something bad. I mean, if you ask anybody what a cult is, it just means bad. Not in sociology, of course, where we have nice technical ideal types. As time went on, there was more of wanting the balance, though. But the balance, I would often be asked to come to provide the balance, or that they had these two sides, and you got the feeling that you had to be in the middle. And this is what really good balanced media work was, to be in the middle. And I felt it was rather like, well, X says that 2 and 2 equals 4, but Y says that 2 and 2 equals 5. So we're going to be really objective and tell you that 2 and 2 equals 4.5, because that's in the middle. And of course it's not like that, it's far more complicated, and sometimes 2 and 2 does equal 4. In fact, usually it does. I found myself, however, being attacked from both sides, but particularly from the opponents. I was called the cult lover. I was called a Moonie. I've been called a Scientologist. I've been a Krishna devotee. I've been a fundamentalist evangelical Christian. And I've also been an anti-cultist. So I'm very multifaceted, as you can see. It was pretty frustrating. Another thing that I'd like to say is that when I I will say it. When I set up in form, because I thought that there was so much unnecessary suffering through misinformation and ignorance about the new religions, which I didn't particularly want to defend for what they were like, but I did want to defend them about what they were not like, if you see what I mean. I thought we would set up in form, which we did, that was 25 years ago, and try and produce this more objective image and offer information, because the media, as Christopher said, don't have time to do much. So they don't do comparative studies with control groups, and they tend to use induction and inference and assume if they've got a story about one person that that applies generally to everyone. I can go on and on and on about that. But when I tried to say things like there were only 161 Moonies when everybody knew that there were thousands because you could see them everywhere, then I got attacked. But when I set up in form, all hell was let loose, and there were petitions to Downing Street, and Margaret Thatcher was there. She set up an investigation. We had men in raincoats coming to investigate us. Luckily, they reported back that we were doing quite good work, so we got some more money. So that was helpful. But the BBC and ITV and the newspapers really gave some pretty horrid attacks. I was villain of the week, for example, in Face the Facts one week. And I asked whether Canon Martin Reardon, who was my vice chairman at Inform, could come and give another picture, and that was the only reason that I would agree to be on the programme. So they said okay, and then they cut him completely. They had some parents who lied, just straightforwardly lied about what we were doing. My husband worked for the BBC at the time, and a friend of his made a recording of the editing that they were doing, and it was absolutely atrocious. What they said, well, if we cut that there, then that will make it look as though, and we'll bring in so-and-so, and we'll call him Reverend because that will give him a certain gravitas, although they knew perfectly well he wasn't a reverend. And sort of things like that, which really shocked me. On the other hand, while I was going through all this, Rosemary Harthill, who was the religious affairs correspondent, supported me very strongly, and she too was shocked at some of the things that were going on. Now, there are people at the BBC that I do trust. Laurie Taylor, I'm always happy to be on his programme, and Ernie Ray, and the World Service, I think, is very trustworthy. But there is some real explicit and overt manipulation and distortion that does go on, which I have found shocking. Nowadays, if they come with a story about me or Inform that we're able to show is untrue, they're less likely to still run it. They just drop it. They don't say this was wrong. So that's another thing. Things have changed quite a bit. I do think, however, that as sociologists, we do have an important role to play. Not to say what is the correct image or the truth, but at least to correct some of the gross distortions that there are. And I'm not talking so much about the Archbishop and Sharia law and the established churches, in which I would include Methodists and almost spiritualists, compared to Moonies or Scientologists, etc. And then just finally, I'd like to say that I do recognize how important communication is and how difficult it is. I mean, really difficult, because we can't just reproduce what's going on. This is something I keep trying to say, and I've tried to say to students, we don't teach communication nearly enough in methodology courses. But it's no good just repeating exactly what a Mooney or a Scientologist would say if they were asked, because they can do that themselves. You also need to understand what people can hear. And there was something about the audience, but not a lot, just because it wasn't that book. But understanding who's going to hear and how they're going to hear it. There are some things that people won't hear, however much you say it, they just close their ears to it. But there are the vast majority, if you aim for them, who can hear, if you present it in a particular kind of way, which means often translation. And the example I often give is if you think of somebody like Laurence Olivier playing Archie Rice in The Entertainer, I don't know if you saw that, he plays a bore, and he is absolutely riveting. He is brilliant as a bore. Now, if he had played a bore boringly, we wouldn't have understood the essence of boredom and boringness nearly as well, because he wasn't boring. And I think sometimes we have to learn how to translate in a way so that what we're saying can be recognized and heard by not just reproducing what's out there. That there is very much an art, not just a flat reproduction that is necessary. Shut up there.
Wonderful. Thanks, Eileen. That was really good to get your perspective and that sort of positive potential way forward there. And I think I've also, through my linguistic gaffe, maybe come up with a term for media coverage, the sect-sy. But we shall see if that catches on. So our final panellist, you've all seen him throughout the conference, is Tim Hutchings. He's a research fellow at the Open University. He's a sociologist of religion, media and culture, and his research interests include digital Christianity, death and media, and digital humanities. He received his PhD on creating church online from the Spurrier University in 2010. And he recently completed a 15-month fellowship at the, is it HUM Lab, or you say HUM Lab, Digital Humanities Research Laboratory at Umeå University in Sweden. And his current work is focusing on the future of the Bible as a digital text. So Tim, over to you.
Oh, thank you very much for listening. I think this is a really interesting book. I didn't agree with all of the book, but I think that's what makes it interesting. There are lots of different perspectives here. Many of them, as Eileen says, not always, but many of them, perspectives of people saying, well, other people don't understand what we do. So I suspect a journalist reading this would think, well, maybe some of the academics and the religious practitioners haven't quite got it, but all the other different components of that would feel the same way about different parts of the book. And I thought that was a lot of fun. The theme that I'm going to try and talk about just for a few minutes here is, as you might guess from my research interests, particularly the internet, the new media, social media side of this book, which is, I've struggled about quite how to describe this. It's kind of half a theme. It keeps coming up. I don't feel it's ever tackled head on in a lot of detail, but a lot of the different contributors to this book feel they need to say something about the internet and what the internet is doing to the news industry. One of the big themes, as you might suspect, in this internet discussion, is the question of payment and paywalls, particularly. Ruth Gledhill rather sweetly promises us that even though her writing is now locked away at the Times behind a paywall, there is still life there, I assure you. It's something that her quote. And a number of the different journalistic contributors actually take issue with this. Some of them suggest that perhaps now her blog is behind a paywall, there is not as much life there as there used to be. And that this paywall experiment may not be the way forward for online news. It would be it's always maybe a good sign when you want a book to be updated as soon as possible. This book is based on conversations that happened in 2009. Some of the contributors to the book say, of course, advertising will never work as a revenue model for news in the internet age. By 2012, the world's biggest newspaper site was the Mail Online, which was making a lot of money from advertising, but in a way that other newspapers were failing to do. So that's a complicated question there that needs to be explored further. Another of the themes that keeps coming up in different books is the idea, in different contributors to this book, is that in the age of the internet and social media, the relationship between an author and the audience has changed. It is an opportunity or possibly a responsibility or sometimes a terrible danger that now readers are going to respond to authors. Journalists have to, and religious practitioners and faith institutions have to say something and then listen to what comes back in response. For some of the contributors, that's very good. Simon Barrow praises the democratization of media, the way in which the internet allows journalism to flourish into lots and lots of supplementary material, interesting blogs that add stories that wouldn't have made their way into print. Andrew Brown, one of the chapters I most enjoyed, is rather more blunt and suggests, I have a quotation of his here, the people we write about no longer need to talk to us, because in the age of social media, if you're a religious practitioner, you can just say what you want to say on Twitter. You don't need to talk to journalists directly. Well, he goes on, the web has made it vastly easier for readers to do so, to talk to us journalists. Almost everyone in the business believes this was a disastrous mistake. His argument there essentially is that readers don't have very interesting things to say to journalists. In particular, the opinions worth having are those of the people who have better things to do with their time. Andrew Brown spends a lot of time in his chapter talking about how difficult it is to edit comments that come in on news websites. Which is certainly a challenge that some people have to deal with. One possibility beyond this, do you talk to your readers, do you not talk to your readers? One possibility suggested by Charlie Beckett is that Ruth Gledhill has succeeded in using Twitter in particular to go outside the paywall of the Times and become, as he says, the hub of a rich and varied specialist news network. So her gift to journalism is not primarily in talking directly to her readers, but in collecting information from lots of different sources, linking to very interesting articles and putting them on her blog, and then sending that information out for other people to find. That's a challenge, I think, an interesting vision of successful media use for religious organizations. How could a faith or institution become the hub of a resource network? One of the other questions that pops up rather infrequently, actually, in the book, is whether the internet requires or needs professional journalism at all. Most of the contributors, as you might expect, are of the opinion that journalism is a very important thing, and the news is a very important thing, and it will continue to be so, and we just need to find ways to pay for it. Andrew Brown, I think, is the only one who is rather more pessimistic, perhaps, about the future of journalism, and suggests that professional expert writing of this kind might only have a very limited audience, might have a very limited function. Maybe we don't need it anymore and it will die. People who don't read newspapers appear to be just as happy as they used to be when they did read newspapers, and this might be something to reflect on. And finally, Jolyon Mitchell's chapter is another of my favourites from this book, the first chapter that is included in the volume. It's one of the few, I think, that tries to make more of an argument about how the internet has affected journalism. And he suggests very briefly that the internet may have turned the agenda-setting role of the media on its head. So there's an idea, very common in media studies or well-known, that the news do not tell people what to think, But they do tell people what to think about. It's newspapers that decide what issues should become the agenda for the society to discuss. In the age of the internet, it certainly looks, perhaps, initially, as if Facebook and Twitter produces stories that everyone begins talking about, and then journalists pick those up a few hours later or a few days later and publish their own reports on what's happened on Twitter today. Possibly. I'm not convinced by that argument. I think that it has been very interesting to see, just in the last couple of days, following the death of Margaret Thatcher, how news media and Twitter and social media have kind of worked together and kind of not to report this story in different ways. The Independent has a story with a headline which runs something like "Death of Margaret Thatcher." The newspapers are respectful while Twitter dances on her grave, suggesting that possibly for the first time, perhaps, I can't think of another example quite like this, traditional and new media have diverged very strongly in their response to a death event. There's a pie chart, which you can see there, which is a meme that was circulated around. Obviously, if you're listening to this recording, you can't see it, but I'll describe it for you. It's entitled "What Twitter Will Look Like on the Day That Thatcher Dies." And I think it's worth bringing up here because it presents a very different point of view to Jolyon Mitchell's idea about agenda setting. The pie chart is divided up into various sections, like people mourning Thatcher's death, people celebrating Thatcher's death, but then there are also a lot of sections of things like people who should be mourning her death, but who are looking at Twitter for people who are gloating in order to be outraged. Journalists looking on Twitter for people who are gloating in order to write articles about the outrage of the people who are looking at the gloating people. And that, I think, was rather prescient. I have found all of those articles now. Certainly there's one section on that pie chart of people who don't know who Margaret Thatcher is and the journalists looking for the people who don't know who Margaret Thatcher is. There were not that many people who didn't know who Margaret Thatcher was, but the Huffington Post and the BBC still came up with an article going, "Look at the children who don't know who Margaret Thatcher is, and here are their tweets." In that context, it seems clear that journalists, as one might expect, and indeed social media users more generally, have particular stories that they want to write, and Twitter is a place where they can go and find the data to write those stories. What that means about who's really setting the agenda for what we talk about, I'm not quite sure. So those are some very quick reflections on what this book has had to say and has not quite had to say about the internet. I think I'll leave my comments there.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Tim.
Good. Well, now the plan is to have we've got just under half an hour left, so the panelists submitted some questions in advance, so I'll pick a couple of those, and then we'll open things to the floor for discussion, really. One thing that was striking me throughout the whole panel there was that, well, this conference is on material religion, and we took this opportunity to do a panel on a book, but didn't really mention material religion at all, so I was wondering what anyone thought about material religion and the news, particularly maybe pertinent to what you were just saying there, Tim, about things shifting to online, and the news used to be a sort of very physical medium. It used to come in sort of set bits that you got a news report at 6 and one at 10, and then you got your paper and that was it, whereas now it's sort of constant and it's much more fluid. So I just wonder if anyone fancies taking that gauntlet that I'm laying down about reflecting on materiality.
Certainly within the BBC there was a very lively discussion about how you fed the new audiences and responded to the increasing 24-hour nature of news, while at the same time recognising that a lot of people still do mark their day by their alarm going off and listening to a particular news programme on the hour, or a particular evening television bulletin. And there were quite fiery debates about how you invested in, say, 24-hour rolling news, and whether that ended up being at the expense of bulletins that remained much, much more popular. Now, that's still within the context of the same medium. But I think perhaps at one level, the whole question of news as a particular product is dissipating. I mean, much of the Twitter stuff, of course, is the triumph of comment and opinion over news, and then the reporting about comment and opinion is then deemed to be news of itself. And it's interesting even to read some of the obituary material in relation to Margaret Thatcher online, and then two-thirds of the way down the story, suddenly you're hearing about this kind of Twitter stuff, and the tone shifts completely. And I think there is an unease at the moment about how to deal with this kind of dissipation.
I suppose the main thought that I would think of is mobile phones and the enormous difference that's made. I mean, the Arab Spring, but other things as well, where you can get somebody who's there on the spot. I'm always amazed at how much more journalists can get than photographers, but they'll never get the stuff that we're getting now from people there just with their mobile phones. And,
There's citizen journalism. I have to jump in, David.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, I mean, the Twitter comments and debate going on about Margaret Thatcher's death is revealing, because it is giving journalists a bit of a challenge. You can see in the newspapers an adherence to more traditional norms, including that I'm not criticising the dead too obviously. And yet, if we think about materiality as significance, the fact that so many people are being so vitriolic is a material issue that needs reporting on in some way. But it's interesting just seeing these few days, you can see the media struggling to handle this as a news item. How do we report on this, and how do we set this in context without joining in any way?
My suspicion is that a lot of the enthusiasm for reporting on Twitter is because then you are not joining in, you are reporting
exactly,
on the
yes,
comment
yes.
of the people who say these outrageous things which you've detailed at length without necessarily saying them yourself. I think that one of the materiality question isn't really raised so much in the book, but there are certainly big differences between the material culture of having a daily newspaper and having access to the newspaper at work in 5 minutes when no one's looking. Certainly, I remember growing up, the complications in the household about which member of the family would have access to which sections of the newspaper at which time. Where there's also a big shift in how news is curated and delivered to people. I, as a person who bought newspapers, would sit down and read more or less from cover to cover and find out about lots of different things. Whereas now I go to the BBC website and the 10 most popular stories of the moment come up, of which 3 or 4 will be silly. 2 or 3 will have something to do with cats, and 3 or 4 will be important things about the world. Which is different. There's a new pressure on newspapers, as online newspapers, to produce very regular, frequent updates of content that may, as you were saying, Christopher, have a much shorter time frame for journalists to put something together quickly, comment on comment, rather than spending days researching something. And those are issues that come out partly of a certain material object and what happens when the boundaries around that material object are dissolved.
Another question which I think 3 people actually submitted, so I'm going to go with it, is religion actually particularly problematic in the media compared with anything else? As academics or religious practitioners, do we just find fault with the media's reporting of the thing that we do? Is there any sense that, in comparison with politics or economics or indeed science, that religion is a special case, or is it just a symptom of the media? Okay, Christopher.
I think there's certainly the danger that religious leaders sometimes make out as they, or imply that all other spheres of human society are treated extremely well and fairly by the media, and it's only religion that is hard done by. But I do think that this question of journalists being disproportionately secular compared to the nation that they are reporting on remains an issue, just in terms of if you are imagining a morning meeting and the question of, well, what's happening in the world that's of significance today? Well, if no one in that circle is part of a mainstream Christian denomination, then whether a new Archbishop of Canterbury or a new Pope is seen really as significant. Now, those are examples where currently the news gods kind of dictate that those are big events regardless. But I think there's probably a kind of slightly lower down the pecking order where those kinds of things are very much in play. Yeah.
I don't know what the figures are, but my impression is that journalism might be quite a male-dominated field, and might that have something to do with the sort of more secular than the rest of society, and indeed the coverage of religion that then comes out of the media?
I don't know. Certainly within the BBC, it's probably less skewed towards men as journalists. I think the other thing to say, of course, is that it does vary hugely from outlet to outlet. And I think, you know, if you were to look at the way ITV reports religion compared to the BBC, you know, there is a huge difference there.
I would have thought it isn't belief that makes the difference, or makes well, it does make a difference if they're fundamentalists or something, or whether they're fundamental atheists or believers. I think the important thing is that they should have knowledge and understanding, not that they should be believers themselves. And sociology, I remember at some point going through, I think the people in this organisation, when I knew everybody a long time ago, and seeing how many were believers and how many were not. And it was roughly 50-50. And the interesting thing was that very often it was the non-believers who were able to give you the smell and the taste of a religion more than the believers, who wanted to be terribly objective and were more quantitative and factual because they didn't want to be involved. Or else there were a few, very, very few, who were fundamentalists and showing that everybody else was wrong because they knew the right thing. So I think your question was implying that belief was a variable that was important in a way that I don't think it is, although I do think it's important for answering another question.
I was going to say one thing about religion, I suppose, is that for people who are active religious practitioners, you're reporting on something that is at least of significance to them, or possibly of ultimate significance to them. And, you know, it may well be that, you know, those who have something to say from within a religious tradition are the ones who are, in a sense, particularly touchy about it. You know, they have a real active concern in seeing how it's reported and what's said about it. That can be positive or negative. You know, good things can come out of that. Very unhelpful things can come out of it. But there is a touchiness there sometimes, which there may not be with other subjects.
That brings me to David. You had a question that you wanted to ask earlier about whether there's a sort of conservative bias, you know, or a resurgence of coverage of traditional religions. Maybe you could phrase it better.
Well, I'll have to come over here so hopefully you can hear me. we were talking with Tim last night, and I mentioned that I think I've seen recently a kind of resurgence of stories about traditional religion, by which I mean Church of England, you know, the old Christian churches in Britain. And moving away slightly from the sort of typical shock value kind of story. And the one that particularly struck me as unusual was the recent one that the BBC and a few other papers carried, where they had the elders of the Church of England criticised the cuts to the welfare system. And there was no real shock value to that. It was a very unusual story. But I'm wondering if there's been a shift so that the new media, the new alternative media, is focusing so much on new alternative religion and spirituality that the traditional media are moving backwards to being concerned with the traditional religion more. If that makes sense.
I mean, that particular example, I think on Easter Sunday, a coalition of, I think it's the Methodist Church, the Baptists, and the United Reformed Church, some years ago decided to develop a common public affairs team, so that when there were social issues which the churches shared a similar view on, that they would try and get media coverage, partly by pointing out how many people that they represented together, and therefore that they were a voice worth listening to. And certainly I was interested that when they entered the welfare debate a couple of weeks after the Church of England had already had its go, and that was reported so widely. And for my money, that was perhaps more a sign of a climate where religious organisations are working much harder to try and get their voice heard, but also where perhaps there isn't the same degree of knee-jerk, why would we want to listen to churches, that perhaps there once was. So I would see it more in terms of the effectiveness of churches getting their voice heard in public, rather than a kind of traditional new media paradigm.
You could say that when Faith in the City came out and there was such a negative reaction, you know, what do they think they're doing? And Muncie got into terrible trouble over that. But at least it was heard. So perhaps, you know, it's quite good if it is shock and horror, because then it's discussed a bit more.
There is maybe also some significance in the fact that, you know, there is a range of religious traditions there which are articulating opposition to a certain set of policies very accurately and also very consistently. And that of itself is significant, actually, particularly perhaps at times when the politicians whom you might expect to be articulating that opposition are not doing it quite so well.
And also, I think, you know, in the current context with that example, again, I remember reading a BBC Online article and with television coverage associated about food banks, and which just then happened to mention that I think it's it's the vast majority of food banks are run by churches in this country. And that was simply reported in the context of a mainstream discussion of welfare. But I think, it's interesting that sort of thing, I think, doesn't always happen. But again, I wonder whether things are changing very gently. I don't know.
But perhaps also with that particular story, the news media were already reporting the story that welfare reform was harmful for a lot of people. So when churches then produce a storyline which suggests establishment figures agree with narrative that news media are already saying, I think it's easier to get that story published or reported on. There have been other points in recent years where churches have tried to produce statements and positions about poverty and haven't got the news coverage that they were hoping for. So this may have just been a moment when the news media were particularly receptive to that message.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
On that note, with an industry in transition, I think we should probably be transitioning into coffee. But I just wanted to thank all our panelists. That was fantastic. Thanks so much for all your papers. Thanks to David for facilitating the audio over there, and to Ashgate for supplying copies of the book, and indeed to all of you for coming. So thanks very much, and enjoy coffee. Mm-hmm.